Good evening, welcome. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to see you here. It's very strange sitting up on the stage here. I'm not accustomed to it. This is the only venue we do this in. And it's a little strange for me to be towering above you like this, since it is so not the way I see things to be. But we're stuck with it. You know, I have not had many times in which, so far as I know, I have had satsang on propitious or auspicious days. I've done satsang on Super Bowl Sundays a couple times, but seldom on days that seem to have spiritual significance. This is an exception, because April 14th is the anniversary of Ramana's death, or Mahasamadhi, as the religious devotees would have it. I prefer death. April 14th, 1950, he was 71 years old. He was born in 1879. And he brought to us a really incredible, simple insight. The people who have kind of claimed Ramana as theirs, the religious people and those in the Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta tradition in India and so forth, they would have it that Ramana was a saint. Bhagavan, they called him. That Ramana was a saint. An ethereal being who somehow came down from heaven to us to transmit to us, bestow upon us the experience of silence and peace and the vastness of being. But so far as I know, that wasn't the way Ramana saw it. Ramana spent most of the time after his profound insight struck him running from us, doing everything he could to escape from us, who ran after his heels trying to get him to bestow upon us this boon, this experience of the hugeness and vastness and emptiness of being and so forth. He declined to speak for 12 years. Later he said that during that 12 years he had told people that he did so because he had taken a sacred vow of silence, but that was a lie. He just told them that because it shut him up. It wasn't necessary for him to go into a lot of explanations. He really just didn't want to talk. It was just that, no big spiritual deal. He just didn't want to talk. Perhaps he had tired of the uselessness of speech to say anything at all about what he had seen in this profound and simple insight that had struck him. And of course, this happened in a context of great spiritual surrounding. India has this atmosphere of spirituality about it. These great beings have trod the soil for all of these thousands of years, and there's this atmosphere of huge spiritual presence about it. So that anything that happens in India, and especially in India where they harbor a religion that accepts everything, absolutely nothing is excluded from Hinduism, So anything that happens in India, especially if it happens in a way that seems to be at all spiritual, is swallowed up into the spiritual context. The spiritual context in which Ramana appeared was the spiritual context of Advaita Vedanta. But his insight, the insight, this profound incomparable, simple insight, really had nothing at all to do with the utterances of Advaita Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta had two basic schools of thought. I mean, at the heart of it was the insight that there is not two, but the actual expression of that insight was quite contradictory. And it spawned two basic schools of thought, both of which were purported to be methods whereby the suffering individual could escape from the context of his or her suffering, their life, into the ever-open, yawning background presence of being, and leave behind their life. Which, of course, seems a little strange in a context that says there is not two, that we should seek this rather than that, and that there should be two contending methods of seeking this rather than that. One of the methods was the negative method, which is the method that goes by the name of neti neti, not this, not this, in which the aspirant, the one who desired to be released from the horror of human life, was to constantly identify and vocally express the characteristics of being that they were not. Not the body, not the mind, not the thought, not the breath, not the bodily functions, not the anything. Not this, not this, not this. The idea being that should the aspirant be able to do so consistently and over a long enough period of time, that they would have disabused themselves of a sufficient mass of characteristics that they were not, that what they were would claim them and they could leave behind this life of suffering and misery and go to wherever it was that they wanted to go to. Maha Samadhi, actually, the dropping of the body, the leaving behind of humanity. The other method for the attainment of Maha Samadhi was the method of positive affirmation. I am Brahman. I am that. I am the unspeakable, the unknowable, the vast, empty, unattainable reality of being. That I am. I am that. Of course, we know I am that. I forget the Sanskrit tat something something. This was the positive method whereby the aspirant could attain Maha Samadhi, the great absorption, the great dropping away of the body and the burdens and the cares and the woes of human existence in favor of something else. And still, all of this sold under the hubris of not two, Advaita, not two. Ramana's insight kind of had no way to fit into that context on one side or the other. Ramana's insight was startling and radical and had nothing whatsoever to do with Advaita or Advaita Vedanta or neti neti or I am that. Ramana's insight was that what one should do is find out what one is. Just that. By no means at all, except by the direct, conscious seeing, experiencing, tasting of the reality of what one is. No need to deny anything. No need to affirm anything. Here you are. That you are is certain. Who can deny that? So Ramana had a hard time in that time in India. The local gurus who had set up shop in Tiruvannamalai, a number of them, they would tell their aspirants, their devotees, their disciples, don't go see Ramana. And this wasn't funny, this was very serious. Do not go see Ramana, because he will ruin your practice. Whether your practice was not this or I am that, guaranteed, Ramana will ruin it. Take it away from you. Ramana didn't care. Truth is, Ramana didn't see any reason why anybody should want to talk to him anyway. And he would have been quite happy if nobody had. I mean, from Ramana's side, there were no aspirants. From Ramana's side, from Ramana's view, all truly is not two. And there was no way for Ramana to have any sense whatsoever of any meaningful difference between you and he. So the fact that you would come to Ramana seeking some boon, some transmission, some teaching, some something, was perplexing to him, puzzling to him. And you can see that in many of his conversations with people. It shines out that he really didn't get it. Why in the world you would be talking to him, calling him Bhagavan, claiming that he was realized, and you were not. There was a time when one of the people who were the first to discover Ramana, from, I think the guy was a Westerner, wrote a book against Ramana, denouncing Ramana, telling everybody that Ramana was a fake and a fraud presenting evidence and facts and so forth to support that. I don't remember the name of the book. The book and the guy who wrote it have disappeared into the mists of history. But the people in the ashram at Tiruvannamalai came to Ramana when this was going on and they said, Ramana, Master, Bhagavan, this guy is selling this book outside of the ashram here, right out at the gate of the ashram. We've got to stop this. And Ramana said, why? Why would you stop it? Let him sell it. He can make a living, and what's the worst that can happen? He'll drive people away. Duh. So Ramana wasn't anything like what I sense is being made of him in these times. It's hard to get a taste of the humanity of Ramana because he lived in such a strange context, so far away, in such a different world, a different surrounding, a different context than we do. And you know, context is everything. When we become spiritual aspirants, we quickly lose sight of that. That's the reason why evangelical Christians speak of the Bible as if every word in there was hewn in stone by God himself. And the words are what are important. The words, somehow those words, just exactly as they are written, are the things where the transmission of salvation and redemption reside. And that's absurd. Words appear in context. And we don't really like it that way. We want for every utterance that falls from the lips of those who we consider to be spiritual great ones to the words themselves to carry some boon, some magical power to release us from this world, this life, this horror show. We think that if we can understand the words that Ramana spoke, that's going to do it for us. If we can understand the words that the Buddha spoke, or Jesus Christ spoke, or God knows who else spoke, that's going to do it for us. But context is everything. Everything. And we have no way whatsoever to recreate within our minds the context from which Ramana spoke. The context was the mind of Ramana Maharshi, and which itself appeared in the context of that time and that place. There are those now who make of Ramana some kind of saint, a god even, Bhagavan. Ramana once speaking to the movement to call him Bhagavan said, if I am Bhagavan, then I can't see anything but Bhagavan in you. If I am Bhagavan, then how can you ask me what you should do? If I am Bhagavan, you are Bhagavan. You are God itself. So the particular way in which Ramana spoke, and he spoke in Tamil, which I don't know anything about. I mean, I don't even know if I pronounce the name of the language correctly. But the mass of the utterances of Ramana that have been translated in English and put in the books and so forth, they are of very limited usefulness to us. And I say that as being one who, in my desperation, in the deepest, most horrifying desperation, carried talks around for a year, as if it were the Bible, but not so. Just reading it, trying to get the context, to hear what Ramana was saying. Not to worship the words or to see how they fit into the Advaita tradition or the tradition of spirituality or Christianity or anything else, Buddhism, but to really get the context, struggling, fighting hard. And I can tell you, the context is everything, and the actual nature of the words are nothing. So that the point of that is that whatever you hear in your desire to know what's real, whatever words you hear from me or from Ramana or from anybody else, the words themselves are nothing. Ramana was 71 when he died. Young man. Half his life he went either up until he was 16 uninterested in this stuff, and then the next 12 years he went not speaking at all. I can tell you one thing absolutely for sure, and that is that in the 35 years that Ramana spoke, he never, ever really figured out how to say what it is he was trying to say. I promise you that. But that doesn't mean you can't hear it. It just means that he couldn't say it. Finally, for me, and this is why Ramana's death, this is one of the reasons why Ramana's death holds such significance to me, personally. You should forgive the expression. Ramana, shortly before his death, you know, he had some kind of cancer in his elbow. I don't know exactly what it was, and the doctors wanted to amputate his arm, and he wouldn't do it. God knows why, he just wouldn't. And he had doctors that were attending to him constantly. He apparently was in great pain. And shortly before his death, he went in to get an examination of the tumor in the elbow. And apparently what the doctors told him was, the time is near. You're pretty much through here. And Ramana came out and was sitting there, and his followers, his disciples, wanted to know what the doctors had said and what was going to happen. And Ramana turned to them and he said, "Well, they tell me that I'm leaving. But how could that be? I am here. I am here." No commentary on that, just reported. And then on to something else. And when I read that, and of course I read it many times because I read talks many times, and every time I came to that point in it, I kind of stumbled. Like, what in the world is he talking about? Is he crazy? I mean, sure to God, Ramana Maharshi isn't telling us that he is going to abide here as the spirit of Ramana Maharshi, and that this body-mind will persist after the body dies. Surely, Ramana Maharshi wouldn't be selling us some kind of a fairy tale like that. And every time I came to that, it stuck me. What does he mean? How could he say that? How could I be leaving? I am here. And finally, and this is what I mean by context is everything, God knows what Ramana really was saying. You know, I don't. But the context, which means the circumstances of this mind, this body mind, this personal consciousness that wrestled with that utterance of Ramana Maharshi, in that context, finally, that utterance, "I am here," broke it all open for me. Just like that. Finally. Of course, he isn't saying anything other than the literal truth. I am here. Here is another name for I. Here is another name for what I am, truly, really. Here is another word that points to the target of Ramana Maharshi's self-inquiry. What is it to be? What is it to be here? What's that feel like, to be here? That you are here is certain. What's that feel like? To be certain that you are here. What are you? What is it to be here? Now, the wild thing about Ramana and the absolute departure that Ramana gives us the opportunity for from all spirituality that has gone before is that Ramana truly saw not to. Because the goal here has nothing to do with escaping from human life. Nothing to do with escaping from the vicissitudes, the horror, the comings and goings of human life. It has to do only with knowing what you are. And the reason that is so critical and so powerful is because Ramana's claim is that you are not your life. And that seeing what you are frees you from, erases and eradicates the belief that you are your life. And that therefore this life has everything at stake in it. Either fixing it, transcending it, transforming it, getting rid of it, escaping from it, going into it, that the life is the center and focus of your being. And it's not. You are not your life. The there is deep within us a long-standing. And you know, Carlos Castaneda, I hate to deviate like this, but Carlos Castaneda has made the claim that we are infected by alien beings who are trying to suck up our life force. You may or may not have known that. That's a later development of Carlos's spiritual teachings. But I can see where that idea would come about, because we are infected with an unseen, unknown belief that I am my life. I mean, think about it. It sounds absurd to say you are not your life. That's how deep-seated and unseen and unconscious and powerful is the belief that you are. And that belief, according to Ramana, is the source, the wellspring, the cause, the reason for all misery, suffering, warfare, aggression, horror, whatsoever in humanity. And there's nothing whatsoever that can be done about it, one way or the other, by doing anything in your life. The only thing that can be done is to get rid of that belief. And the only way to get rid of that belief is to see what you are. The truth is the only solution. And not in the sense of the truth, oh, I see the light. I get it, I see the light, all is clear now. But in the sense of the incremental, repeated doses of the actual conscious tasting of the reality of what you are, without regard to any connection between that and the gradual freeing up and ease-making that comes when the idea that you are at stake in this goes. Now, there's a lot of room for confusion. There's a lot of opportunity in the course of this practice of self-inquiry to get caught up in arguments as to why you are your life. The wondrous thing about Ramana's practice that makes it so different from everything else, that doesn't matter. You don't need to understand it. You don't need to believe in it. You don't need to see anything happening as a result of it. All that you need to do is do it. Like you take medicine. Like you take an antibiotic for an infectious disease. Just this, right here, in this moment, as you're here, stop for 1 second, and instead of looking at the objects that normally catch your attention, the thoughts, the ideas, the expectations, the bodily sensations, instead of that, look and see if you cannot see what it feels like just to be here. Just that. Just to taste it, not to explain it. Just that. What is it that's here now that's never been absent? What is it that's here now that has never changed? Just that. And the promise is that if you will do this, every time it occurs to you, you don't have to stop doing your other practices, whatever they are, physical practices, material practices, psychological practices, spiritual practices. Doesn't matter. You don't have to stop doing them. You don't have to keep doing them. You just do this as often as you can, whenever it occurs to you. Stop for 1 second and look and see, are you here? Have you changed? Really? Are you different? Just for a second. And that'll do it. That's the promise. That's the claim. That'll do it. That here is what Ramana was speaking of when he said, I am here. That here is you. And that's self-inquiry. That's Ramana's insight. Nothing more to it. And you may go on in your life and write hymns and spiritual poetry and sutras and shastras and all of that. You may not. You may, God knows what you may do or may not do. No matter what you do, no matter what you don't do, you absolutely will be untouched and unaffected by any of it. Whether what you do is smart or dumb, you are untouched by any of it. You are the same. And the point of that is not to take on a new belief about what you are, but to point to what you already are. The point of all this speech, of all this talking, is only to try to find some way in context to say to you, this is the target. If you can just do this, everything will come out right. If you can just taste this, everything will turn out right in the end. Just do this. And that's what's so hard. And that's why there is such a range of spiritual practices in the world, even among those who know better. Okay, so that's it. That's all I'm here for. That's all I want in life, is to find some way. I wish I could find just the right way that I could just tell everybody in the world this. Look, you don't have to know why. Just taste this. It can't hurt you. It is you. How can it hurt you? Just taste this. I wish I could trick everybody into just doing this as often as they can. Ah, well. Okay, I'm done. It's your turn. Yes. You do. If I have to, you have to.
Okay.
It's not two here.
I'm afraid of it.
Easy. Don't hurt yourself.
I'm afraid of being
here too. Why is that?
I don't know exactly.
Well, it's okay.
Because I want to tell you.
It's okay.
How you treat me.
Well, that's what I want to know. I'm happy to see you.
Had an experience.
Could you just hold it up? You don't have to do anything.
Okay. While I was in L.A., my daughter's dog had a seizure in the middle of the night, and we didn't know what it was that was going on, and she woke up from it. We tried to soothe her, and she woke very alarmed, and she was running in her sleep as dogs will, but this was frantic. It was like 100 miles an hour. It looked like heart beating so fast. And when she woke and we were trying to soothe her, I was behind her. My daughter was in front of her. The children were asleep in the bed next to us. And she seemed to be all right. She got up. She walked over into the corner of the room. She peed. And she started to bark at us wildly, fiercely, and really terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And so we thought there must be something that we needed to do for her. So my daughter called, long series of phone conversations, and I was sitting trying to lure her out of the room, and she was growling, and she's the gentlest of dogs, gentle, sweet dog. She was totally disoriented. And the children started to wake up, and I told them to stay in the bed. And I had this feeling that I would have to distract the dog away from the children. And at the time, I had no idea what was going on with her, except that she had foamed at the mouth, and I knew only a little bit about rabies, and I thought maybe she's been bitten, and she was a rabid dog. And I surrendered to the fact, which wasn't a fact at all, and I reinterpreted the whole thing later, but at the moment, that I might die. I've never felt that way before. And at that moment, I knew what you were saying just now. And I was terrified in one way. My body was shaking like it is now, actually. But a deep something was saying that it didn't matter. And I love life. I love my life. I love to be alive. I love a lot of people. But it was way beyond all of that. And so what you said today just resonated very, very deeply with me.
You know, that's exactly what happened to Ramana. When he was 16 years old, he was, for no reason that was apparent, he was struck with overwhelming fear of death and certainty that death was coming for him. And it was in the midst of that fear of death that he determined to discover who dies. And of course he was never the same. It's now you can, that reality that underlies, from which arises the certainty of death, the love of life, all of that, right? That reality is here. It's never absent. There is, it's not my experience, and this is one of the burdens that we carry as a result of our minds developing in the context in which they develop. We carry this burden of expectation of sudden, once and for all, finishing of the stupidity of me. And maybe that happens. It didn't happen for Ramana like that. It wasn't once and for all for Ramana. Ramana went and hid away in a temple in Tiruvannamalai for a long time, doubtless struggling with the ramifications of what had happened to him. I was only 16, for God's sake. The gift that's been given to you is the taste of what is always here. And the possibility for you is to deliberately, consciously, with your personal consciousness, whenever you can, taste that again. There is no way that you can argue yourself out of this belief that you are your life. There is nothing that is sinful or wrong with that belief. It just causes all the trouble. The one thing that dissolves that belief is the repeated tasting of the truth. Because the belief isn't the truth. So that what I hope and what I pray is that as time goes on, you will find yourself again and again stopping and tasting that that made itself known to you in the drama of that circumstance. And the amazing thing about it is that, like when something big like that happens, right, we are shaken by it. And when we recount it, we are shaken again by it. But the truth is not very shaking at all. The truth is commonplace. I mean, the truth is here always. The truth isn't something that suddenly appears and then goes back into hiding for us to scramble after it again. The truth is here always. It's commonplace. It's ordinary. So it is also commonplace, given the context of the development of our personal consciousness, to have this expectation of the shaking being the thing. It's not. It's that ever-present reality that is the thing. And what you can do is, and I want you to, is every time you get a chance, check and see if that's not still here. And if that's been changed, just check and see. And I promise you that as time goes on, all the sense of fraughtness about this life will vanish. It's not that the life will, you will not necessarily become a saint, right? You will not necessarily come to a full understanding of the way of things and so forth, but all the sense of something's at stake here, that goes away. The sense that I am touched by the stupidity of this life or the wonder of this life goes away. And then...
It goes away too. I don't
know. No, but you must see, right? No, the wonder doesn't go away. You know, that. Why would it? That's what life is, the constant... rising and falling of these opposing states. But you must see that in the wonder, just as in the stupidity, you are untouched. You are unaffected. And quite to the contrary of what we would expect, in the absence of this sense that something is really big in this life, this life reveals itself to be really sweet and quite enjoyable and actually quite wondrous. This life is the eyes and ears of this reality that you are, truly. But the particulars of the way in which it shapes itself is of no consequence. But to see that, you have to look and see. This that you have seen, am I here still? Have I changed? When you find yourself out in nature and see this glorious, wondrous, like you see that I was driving here tonight and looking at the hills and the light, and it's all unbelievably beautiful. The light here is magnificent. In the midst of that, stop for a second and check and see. Am I here? Have I changed? Yes, this is a gorgeous, glorious state. But have I changed? And in the midst of, oh man, I've lost it. I had it. I know I had it. In the midst of that horror story, I had it and I've lost it. Stop for a second and look and see. Am I here? Have I changed? Am I touched by this? Not... The purpose of that is just to take the medicine. The medicine being the conscious, direct experience of what you are. Okay?
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm very happy to see you like this. Thank you, Alan. Don't fall. It's the hard part. You know, I mean, really, we are conditioned in the whole way that we are born and raised and taught breeds this expectation in us that something big is going to happen and everything will be settled. And of course, what we mean by everything's going to be settled is that all my stupidity will go away and all my brilliance will remain. Anybody else? Okay. The microphone's the important thing.
How to be detached from circumstances and at the same time engaged.
You need to move the microphone a little closer.
And at the same time engaged in life.
But you see, I'm not asking you to be detached or to be engaged. What I'm saying is that detached or engaged is not your business. That detachment and engagement happen on their own. They are the spontaneous unfolding of this mind-body, this personal consciousness. The mere fact that you ask the question makes it apparent that you must have seen that you can't by any means make yourself be detached, although sometimes you feel detached. And you can't by any means make yourself be engaged, although sometimes you feel engaged. The reason for that is because these experiences and states of detachment and engagement are just the mechanical, spontaneous unfolding of this personal consciousness. They're the shape of it, the characteristics of it, as it plays in the world. And it is precisely the effort to make this personal consciousness conform to some spiritual standard that causes all the spiritual suffering. What I tell you is that, and I don't, you know, you can try to do that. That can't hurt you, can't help you or hurt you. But what I tell you is that even if you try to be detached, or try to be engaged, or try to reconcile those two states, even as you're doing that, look and see what you are. Look and see if you are indeed the one who is trying to do that. And if you find that what you are is here, unmoving, absolutely the same, has no stake whatsoever in whether you are detached or engaged, then what is it to you? Then the idea that there's a stake for you in this vanishes. And this warfare that we are waging against the foolishness of the personal consciousness, against its inability to do right, this warfare that we're waging against that ceases. And the personal consciousness is permitted to just continue on doing what it does. Who cares? Who's harmed by it? Who's helped by it, really? So, when this feeling of the importance of doing things right appears, it's not the feeling that's the problem. It's not the trying to do things right that's the problem. It's the idea that you are the one who is affected by all of that that is the problem. And the only solution to that is to see what you are. And what you are is what's always here. You know that you're always here. You can't deny that, right? No matter what else is going on, you're here. So you look for that, just for a second, without the idea that, or even with the idea, it really doesn't matter, but without the idea necessarily that looking for that is going to solve the dilemma of the way the life unfolds. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but what am I really? First, before everything else, what am I really? Ramana tells us all beings want happiness. And the fact that all beings want happiness begs the question, what am I? What is this that wants happiness, that wants the reconciliation of detachment and engagement? What is this? What am I? Really? You follow that? Okay? It's medicine. It's not spiritual. It's medicine. And it's okay to be spiritual. Being spiritual can't help you, can't hurt you. Can't help you, can't hurt you. But reality is not spiritual. Reality is you, here, always, unmoving, unchanging, untouched, unaffected. You, that which causes the surprise from time to time that that person in the mirror should have changed so, since I am the same. I am as I was when I was 3.
What about the part of me that is changing? Is it also part of...
Yes, it's not that. And this is the inclination in all spiritual yearning is to find what needs to be gotten rid of and get rid of it. And the inclination mostly in all spiritual yearning is to escape from me, especially in the more advanced spiritual teachings, to get rid of me so that the bigger I can, you know, be, and so forth. The practice of self-inquiry has no interest in getting rid of or keeping this little me. It has no interest in hurting or helping this little me. The practice of self-inquiry is solely concerned with the truth of what I am. And I may discover that I am, well, this weird, creepy, wanting this, not wanting that, you know, yearning, wanting, not getting, crazy being. If that's the case, then so be it. We should know that. I say it's not so. But that's not to say that there's anything wrong with this personal consciousness. The reason the idea arises that there's something wrong with the personal consciousness is the belief that this is what something has to be done about, that this is the problem, that the existence of personal consciousness is the problem with all of its vicissitudes, with all of its wanting this, wanting that, getting rid of that. The reason why the whole jihad against personal consciousness exists is based in the belief that I am personal consciousness, and this is what has to happen. This has to change. There's no part of this in self-inquiry. Self-inquiry is very gentle with the craziness of personal consciousness. It doesn't seek to change it. It doesn't seek to do away with it. It seeks only to know the truth of what I am. And in that seeking, the craziness, the goodness, the wonder, the horror, the stupidity, the brilliance, all of that, of personal consciousness are beside the point. Just while looking for the reality, that's beside the point. The fact is that if you want to be good to this personal consciousness, first find out what you are. First find out what you are. You are not this that changes. And you know it. You are here, whether personal consciousness is crazy or brilliant. You are the same. And that's the target of the inquiry. Find that. taste that again and again. And do whatever you need to do, you know, to make your life better, to make this little me less subject to misery and all of that. Do all of that. But in between that, look and see what you are. Do you follow that? It's very hard to speak of this. It is so ordinary and customary to either celebrate personal consciousness and say everything is based in personal consciousness and we have to make personal consciousness so that it is integrated and whole and so forth, at peace, or to say personal consciousness is the problem and we've got to get rid of it, we've got to do something about it. Got to stamp it out, down with ego. Get rid of ego. Ramana has no truck with any of that. Self-inquiry isn't interested in any of that. Really. You can keep trying to kill off ego as far as self-inquiry cares. Just find out what you are. Find out what you are. Again and again, look for the truth of what you are. And see if it isn't the case that over time, that whole hot fire of warfare doesn't begin to just kind of fade. And this little me is quite happy. Really. Okay, is that helpful? Okay. Anything else? Yes. What's your name?
Susan,
hi. Have we spoken before?
No. So if this self-inquiry does not require one to be good.
Right. Doesn't require you to be bad either.
But if you are bad.
That's right.
And if you are bad.
If you are.
If you do deliberately hurtful things to other people, as I do, is that also not mattering? Is it a completely amoral practice?
It certainly cannot stop, yes it is, it certainly cannot stop you from looking for the reality of what you are. The fact that Susan may be deliberately harmful and just a really bad person doesn't stop you from looking to see if you are Susan. Okay?
Cool.
Nothing stops you. Nothing is in the way of this. The game here is to know the truth. And the truth is the solution. There is no other, and we know that. We've tried all the rest. Okay? Anybody else? This is so hard to get right. It's so hard. I mean, here I am, right? I've been trying for 8 years to find out what it is that I'm trying to say, and then trying to figure out how it is I can say it. I'm not doing very well, but I'm doing better. Ramana tried for 35 years, and he was under actually much more difficult circumstances than I am, because he was surrounded by a whole realm of energy that knew what he was talking about. Duh. Oh, we know what he's talking about. It is so simple. You don't need to be good. You don't need to be bad. You don't need anything at all. You don't need to stop your practices. You don't need to understand this. All you have to do is know that you're here. And look at that. Like medicine. Okay. Bob, did you? No? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for joining me in this remembrance of Ramana's death and his life and the incredible gift that even though he didn't want to, he gave to us. If only we will really hear it. I can't tell you how easy it is. It doesn't matter if you don't understand it, if you think it's something other than it is. As long as you look at what it feels like to be here, that's all it takes. As often as you can. Am I right? Okay. Thank you again for this time. Thank you for this satsang. Om Shanti. May all being know itself.